This will be the sixth commandment, thou shalt not murder, part six. In some of the previous messages, I addressed or have been addressing different aspects of voluntary or intentional homicide. And we're going to continue with that for another couple messages at least. And of course, at this particular time in our history, when one thinks of intentional murder, one can't help but think of the tragic multiple homicides at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado that occurred on April 20th, 1999. And our hearts, of course, and our prayers go out to the parents, families, and friends of those 14 students and one teacher. At least I think that's how it broke down, wasn't it? Wasn't there just one teacher and then 14 students that were ruthlessly gunned down in cold blood? And I hope that you have prayed for those people. You know, sometimes in today's society, things happen. It's splashed all over the news so much. There's this happening and then this tragedy over here happening. And I think we find ourselves removed from those situations. And we fail to realize that there's real living parents and sisters and brothers and friends that are having to live through the worst tragedy of their life. And we need to pray for those people. And I hope that we'll continue to do so because it certainly may be tragic in their life for some time to come. And be not mistaken, the blood of those 15 innocents are crying out for justice in a society where little or no justice at all can be found, even though their killers killed themselves. And it would, let me guarantee you this, that even if those killers hadn't killed themselves, that blood would definitely still be crying out for justice in this day and age. Because under the court system we have, it's unlikely that they would get the justice that really do them, that God's law requires. Nevertheless, as tragic, as horrific as that mass murder was a week ago or 2 weeks ago this coming Tuesday, nevertheless, the blood of those 15 innocent people that has raised so much ire and sympathy from so many left-wing anti-gun liberals is drowned out by the silence and the lack of compassion from those same quote-unquote humanitarian, quote-unquote empathetic, quote-unquote benevolent liberals. What am I talking about? Well, simply the epitome of innocent blood. The gruesome butchering or poisoning of untold numbers of innocent. And let me tell you, and you'll think you'll see why by the end of this message, why I say untold numbers. They pretty much got to figure what they tell you. But it is so far more than that, that it is without question, untold numbers of innocent, harmless babies while in the wombs of their mothers. Wow. Their sympathy and their cries are drowned out, for those 15 are drowned out by the silence of untold millions upon millions of cries of the innocent babes that were slaughtered in the wombs of their mothers. Not only are the same liberals, for the most part, unaffected, unmoved by this mass murder plot, but they are also fellow participants in the same by their support and promotion of the same. And let me tell you, are just as guilty of murder, either directly or as accomplices, as were Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. Just as guilty of murder. One of the previous messages, I was elaborating upon the different types of homicide, and I mentioned that there are two types that the liberals want to debate over whether they are actually murder or not. The first, of course, was or is suicide, or self-murder, including physician-assisted murder. And the second, of course, is infanticide. That is infant murder. But of course, the proponents of what's commonly known as abortion do not want this infamous crime labeled as infanticide for obvious reasons. As I pointed out on other occasions, had Roe versus Wade been waged over infanticide rather than abortion, the case would have never even made it to the judicial arena. One cannot debate over infanticide any more than one can debate over homicide or fratricide or patricide or matricide, etc., etc. You can't debate. You can't go to a court. No court in the land would have heard a case. Now, I'm not so sure that we're not coming to a day when maybe the courts have digressed to the point they would. But in that day and age, there would have been no court in the land that would have heard a case about infanticide, whether infanticide was something that could be termed legal or not. It just couldn't be done. They won, as I pointed out, by a slick use of terms. They won before they ever even got to the courtroom. Some of the people who have realized the abuse and adulteration of this terminology have realized that there's been a problem here with the term abortion, and have instead, I've heard this many times, that have said instead that what it should be called is aborticide or feticide. However, the proponents of infant murder, let me tell you, would have won Roe versus Wade just as easily if with the term aborticide. And that's what normally people are wanting to call it today. I've heard preachers across the land say, it's not abortion, it's aborticide. Well, they'd have won just as easily over aborticide. Why? Well, simply because you can't murder and abort. It's a worse term than abortion. If anything, because side means to murder. And the first part of the word is what you're murdering. You can't murder and abort. The term feticide, Latin from what I understand for the murder or death of a little one. I'm not absolutely positive, but I think that's the Latin for that term. Andy, maybe you can check that out for me. Would be proper. Possibly even more so in certain cases or at certain stages of the growth of the baby in the womb. If the controlling wordsmiths of our day hadn't already turned a fetus in the minds of the people into something non-living or something non-viable. But isn't that what they have done? They've taken the term fetus. It's certainly not today, when you use the term fetus, it's certainly not understood to mean, or people don't think in their minds, of a little one. Instead, it's just a mass of tissue or whatever. It's a non-living. When they say fetus, it's a non-living thing. It's a non-viable thing. And consequently, if we are ever going to win this battle, we must stop talking about abortion, about aborticide, and about feticide, and call it what it is. Infanticide. The murder of an infant. In other words, we've got to stop playing in their court. And they do it time and time again. They try to get us to battle on their grounds, on their conditions. And if we do, we're going to lose the battle. We've got to stop playing in their court. We've got to stop battling on their battlefield. And we've got to get them into our court. His court. I haven't thought about that. But his court is where we've got to get them into. Our court really doesn't cut it either, does it? So, the next time you hear somebody talking about abortion, just simply ask them, don't you mean infanticide? And think about that. You know, I've mentioned in previous times that it doesn't take that much to get our people to start thinking again. You know, think about it. Just asking that question, they start talking about abortion, and say, well, no, wait a minute, don't you mean infanticide? I don't care which side of the issue they're on. Just say, don't you mean infanticide? And man, their mind all of a sudden just opens up the door for them to see things in such a different fashion. And that's just one example. There are many things. If we just think about when somebody says something for us to come back with, not antagonistically and saying, you know, and trying to shove it down the throat, but just ask it in a question form and say, now, wait a minute, have you thought about it this way? You're talking about abortion. Well, don't you really mean infanticide? Are you talking about a miscarriage? Or are you talking about the murder of an infant? What are you talking about? Because abortion is, a miscarriage is as much abortion as anything else could be. There is. Of course, the whole issue regarding infanticide revolves around the question of where life begins, does it not? And the only one, that's the question that so often they're trying to debate. But let me tell you, the only one who has the right to answer that question is the one who created life. He's the one. He knows when life begins. But someone may respond to that by saying, but yeah, but I don't believe in creation. I believe in evolution. Well, then let evolution answer the question for you. You say, what are you talking about, preacher? Well, this is one preacher that believes in evolution. That's right, I believe in evolution. And I think if you'll think about it, that you'll admit that you do too. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about the untenable, unprovable, non-provable, I think is the more correct term, and unscientific, and yes, I said unscientific evolution that's being taught in today's public school system, and across the media, and across TV, and all the programs. And I said unscientific. They have propagandized as if it's the scientific approach. Talk about a con job. We have fallen for the biggest con job, or at least one of the biggest con jobs ever created. The lie that Romans 1 talks about that started way back in Genesis chapter 3. It is not scientific at all. It doesn't even qualify as a theory. It is nothing but a hypothesis at the best. You want to talk about science? Science has proven. You take the creation scientists, and not that they've got everything right. They've got some problems in some of what they teach as well. But generally, you take the creation scientists and you put them in debates with the evolution, quote-unquote, scientists, and the creation scientists win, hands down. I've been to one of those debates at Colorado State University many years ago. I mean, it was so obvious. Had I been on the opposite side, it would have been obvious that that was the case. But they had absolutely won, hands down. And they have done debates all over the country, but very few people even know about it. Very few people even know that there is a scientific approach when it comes to creation. I say unscientific. That's not the evolution that I believe in. Nevertheless, I do believe in evolution. In fact, I'll go so far as to even use the Webster's 1975 New Collegiate Dictionary's definition of the same to illustrate my point, at least part of it. Here's how it begins. Evolution. Latin evolution, evolutio, unrolling from evolutus. A process of change in a certain direction, unfolding. And then another one, a process of continuous change from a lower, simpler, or worse to a higher, more complex, or better state. Growth. And then, of course, from there it goes into some other things, talking about economics and, of course, the idea that Darwin began. I'll even go so far as to use the definition that evolution is the process by which one life form develops into another life form. I'll go so far as to even use that one. I don't believe in the evolution of species. It's very clear scientifically and biblically that species were by special creation. I don't believe in the evolution of species that cannot be found, in fact, is conspicuously missing from the fossil record. And that can really only be found in the fertile or prolific imaginations of the evolutionists. I don't believe in that, but I do believe in the evolution or the evolving of life, or if you prefer, the evolving of one life form into another life form that is both observable and scientifically proven that has occurred in the womb of every pregnant woman from the dawn of history. The evolution of an embryo to that of a fetus, which is certainly much more than just a mass of tissue, to that of an embryo, using the terms properly as they should be used. Is that not a process of evolution? Evolving, as the term. I mean, we think evolution and we automatically think of the Darwinian concept. Evolution is just, I mean, there's lots of things that evolve. And that is really an evolving, if you will, from one, it's still one, it's always been one and the same thing, but it's, in a sense, a different life form into a different life form into a different life form. But it's evolution in that sense. And that is one place where evolution is both scientifically demonstrable and with today's modern medical equipment, is even observable. I mean, you talk about scientific. You talk about scientifically solid. Man, that's an evolution that's got it down pat. Thus, if you believe in evolution, even evolution demands that life begins at conception. You know, what evolutionist in their right mind, from their standpoint, from their worldview, what evolutionist in their right mind would want to stop their evolutionary process at the amoeba stage? You know, you stop it at the amoeba stage and you stopped everything else that they think links back to it. Or what evolution? Let's not even talk about that ridiculous position, that ridiculous hypothesis of evolution as they think of it. Let's think about what evolutionist in their right mind would want to say that it really doesn't matter if you take the cocoon of a butterfly and destroy it because it really isn't life. You know? Well, could you ever get a butterfly without it? Can you ever get a man without what's conceived in the womb of a woman? That evolution in the womb of a mother is also, of course, by the design of the Creator, is it not? And so the final word on this issue of when life begins is to be found. The final word is to be found in His Word. So let's go to His Word, beginning with Exodus 21. In verses 22 through 25. Exodus 21, beginning with verse 22. And it says, "If men strive and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart from her, yet no mischief follow, he shall be surely punished, according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. And if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, and stripe for stripe." Let me read that to you now from the New American Standard, just for the clarity's sake. It says, "And if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage, yet there is no further injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, and bruise for bruise." In other words, if two men are struggling together, and in the struggle a man's pregnant wife is somehow injured in the altercation, and as a consequence gives birth to the child. The one who caused the premature birth is lawfully liable. If the baby lives and no further injury has occurred or has come to it, then the perpetrator, if the father of the child so determines, is financially liable to the amount that the judges determine. The father can't, he can determine whether he wants something paid, but he cannot determine the amount. The judges must determine that. Verse 22 in the NIV, I'm not one who promotes the NIV, but in this case I think it gives special clarity to this passage and a few others to come. Verse 22 in the NIV puts it this way. It says, if men who are fighting hit a pregnant woman and she gives birth prematurely, but there is no serious injury, the offender must be fined whatever the woman's husband demands and the court allows. However, if the child lives but is somehow injured in the fracas, then the perpetrator is to pay eye for eye, tooth for tooth, limb for limb, etc., etc. In other words, if as a consequence of the tragedy, a child's arm, he's born, he lives, but his arm is deformed. That's right. God's law demands that if the father so determines, that the man who caused the casualty is to have his own arm amputated. Now that may seem awfully gruesome, but the whole purpose of all of that was to promote personal responsibility. Something in this day and age we know very little of. As gruesome as that is, I choose God's way over what we have today, where society has to pay rather than the individual. Which is more just? I mean, it makes you think. All of God's laws, and we're going to see some as we continue in this series, God's laws were to be preventative in nature, man. If I know that I can lose my arm because of what I do unjustly to someone else with malicious intent, I'm going to think twice. I'm going to do more than think twice. I'm not even going to consider the possibility. It was to prevent, if prevention didn't work, it was to promote personal responsibility and make the individual responsible for his own actions. However, continuing in the scenario, if the child is either born too prematurely to live, or if he dies due to additional injuries occurred in the brawl, the perpetrator in that case is to pay what? Life for life. You think about that. The woman, the child, it wasn't a child that in this brawl got hurt. I mean, that was already born with a child, but it wasn't born yet. This is speaking, according to God's law, according to God's morality, that if a child was born as a result, either too prematurely to live or died subsequently, that the perpetrator was to forfeit his own life for the child. How could that be? Unless life began in the womb. And note that there are no conditions attached to this sixth commandment statute. There are no conditions. No conditions such as, if the fetus is viable, he pays life for life. Or if the woman in her pregnancy is in the third trimester, he is to pay for his life. There wasn't any conditions put on it at all. If the woman at any stage in her pregnancy miscarries and the child perishes, it's life for life. Why? Well, because innocent blood had been shed. No matter how old the child or the fetus was in its development as a human life. Now, let me deviate for just a moment or two. And it's not really too far of a deviation, but I thought you'd find this interesting. You would think that in light of Exodus chapter 21 and what we read in those three or four verses, that the Jews, who once again are supposed to be the proprietors, at least in the minds and how they've portrayed themselves in the minds of not only the secular world, and probably most of them could care less or don't even know about it, but even more so in the religious, in the Christian world today, you would think that the Jews who are supposed to be the proprietors of Yahweh's law, that in light of Exodus 21, that they would be first in line opposed to infanticide. Would you not? You think so? They're supposed to be the ones who are supposed to be the ones following. That's supposed to be their religion. Well, surprise, surprise. At least if you're amongst most of Judeo-Christianity. Contrast what we just read in Exodus chapter 21, Israel's law, with the Talmud, the Jews' law. Let me guarantee you, if you don't already know it, which all of you do, it's definitely two different things. I'm going to be quoting initially from the Jewish Encyclopedia, Volume 6, page 453, which references the Talmud for almost all of these statements, and I don't recognize and didn't have the time or take the time to look up all the abbreviations and what their term was, so I may just say Talmud references as I get to these. But actually quoting from the Talmud, because that's what the Jewish Encyclopedia and the Encyclopedia Judaica is referencing. Under the heading homicide, under the subheading condition of murderer and victim, you know, like all of a sudden this is going to matter. You know, it's just another manipulation of how they say, okay, under these conditions, you know, not found in God's law, just being made up out of here in the blue somewhere. They say under these conditions. So under the subheading condition of murder and victim, listen to what it has to say. Quote, as to the victim, the rabbis understand by the term, and it has the Hebrew term for man, which is probably Adam, used in connection with the crime, Exodus 21:12, Leviticus 23:17, a person, hence male or female, free or slave, old or young, then it gives some Talmudic references, that's saying that that's what that's referring to. But then it says, if young, by which is meant a newborn infant, it must be proved that it was not of premature birth, even if it lived. If prematurely born, it must be at least 30 days old to be considered a human being. And it gives some more references from the Talmud. Then it continues. But the unborn child is considered as part of its mother, Sanhedrin 80b, killing it in its mother's womb is therefore a finable offense only. Contrast, the difference. Encyclopedia Judaica, Volume 8, page 945, under the heading homicide, we find this. And listen how this one and this is a later, much later issue. Jewish Encyclopedia was in the early 1900s, 1904, 1905, about in there. The Encyclopedia Judaica, if I remember correctly, is either 1940s or 1960s. Notice how this ever-living, as they term it themselves, religion has now changed it just a little bit. In the Jewish Encyclopedia, it mentions that if it's born prematurely, it has to live for 30 days before it's considered a human being. Watch the evolution in this case. Encyclopedia Judaica, Volume 8, page 944, under the heading homicide. As regards liability to capital punishment, it does not matter even that the victim was a newborn infant, gives the Talmudic references, provided he was viable for at least 30 days. End of quote. Nothing about premature. Now any infant, premature or otherwise, must live 30 days before it's considered a human being. And if it's put to death, is punishable by the death penalty. Always changing, always working, always going further than as far as they can to get away from what the law actually teaches or tells us. Continuing the Encyclopedia Judaica, Volume 2, page 98 through 100, several quotes here I want to share with you. Under the heading abortion itself, this is the only Jewish encyclopedia of the four I have that even dealt with abortion, but this one's pretty revealing. Under the subheading, in the biblical period, quote, a monetary penalty was imposed for, listen to this, for causing abortion of a woman, of a woman's fetus in the course of a quarrel, and the penalty of death if the woman's own death resulted therefrom. Now I ask you, you go back and you read Exodus 21 and 23 again and see if that's what it says to you. A woman who was maliciously hurt was already taken care of under the provisions of the law. And I can, you know, somebody could twist it and make it read that. But it's already taken care of. That is obviously dealing with the child who was born prematurely as a result of the quarrel. Going on, giving some Talmudic references, and then it says, the Talmudic scholars, however, maintain that the word harm in that passage refers to the woman and not to the fetus. So in other words, you can harm the fetus, but not the woman. Under the heading later, under the heading, subheading, in the Talmudic period, it says, in Talmudic times, as in ancient Halakha, abortion was not considered a transgression unless, watch the language that's used, and think about the same terminology and where we hear it from today. In Talmudic times, as in ancient Halakha, abortion was not considered a transgression unless the fetus was viable. Give some references from the Talmud. Later, in the view of R. Ishmael, only a Gentile to whom some of the basic transgressions applied with greater stringency, wait a minute, I thought Yahweh's laws, even if they are Israel, that when the non-Israelite lived with Israel, that the same laws applied to all one and the same. But this says, in the view of R. Ishmael, only a Gentile to whom some of the basic transgressions applied with greater stringency incurred the death penalty for causing the loss of the fetus. Sanhedrin 57b. So, in their sight, since they think they're Israel, and we're non-Israel, only we would pay the death penalty if we caused the death of the child from the womb of the mother. Another little bit later. Abortion is permitted if the fetus endangers the mother's life. Thus, if a woman travails to give birth, and it is feared she may die, one may sever the fetus from her womb, and listen to this, and extract it member by member, for her life takes precedence over his. Some of that was quote within a quote from OHO, whatever Talmudic book that represents, 7 and verse 6. Continuing later, when the mother's life is endangered, she herself may destroy the fetus, even if its greater part has emerged. Sounds like partial birth abortions to me. Partial birth infanticides, excuse me. Quote within a quote, for even if in the eyes of others the law of a fetus is not as the law of a is as the law of a pursuer. In other words, it's something, it's like what's the word I want to use? Another word for pursuer, there's a better word. It's something that's out to destroy the life of another. All of a sudden, this child becomes, in that case, a victimizer. There's a better word. You'll have to come up with it on your own. And it continues, the mother may yet regard the fetus as pursuing her. End of quote from another Talmudic quote. A couple more. The majority of the later authorities maintain that abortion should be permitted if it is necessary for the recuperation of the mother, even if there is no mortal danger. I mean, they just keep going further and further and further with it. Attaching to the pregnancy, and even if the mother's illness has not been directly caused by the fetus. And again, they give Talmudic quotes. And then lastly, a quote, a similar view was adopted by Benzian Mayor Hai Uziel, namely that abortion is prohibited if merely intended for its own sake, but permitted, quote within a quote, if intended to serve the mother's needs, ellipsis, even if not vital. End of quote within a quote. And who accordingly decided that abortion was permissible to save the mother from the deafness which would result, according to medical opinion, from her continued pregnancy. And then it cites the references as well, end of quote. And a mother, if she fears she might, if the medical doctor says you're going to be deaf from bearing this child, may take the child's life. You want to know where infanticide, not only in the womb, but up to 30 days after it's been born, was first made legal? Legal, not lawful. Well, I think you've just been given a pretty good idea. The terminology that's used by Planned Parenthood, what a dichotomous term, Planned Parenthood, when their main design is to destroy the child that makes one a parent. But the same terminology that's used by Planned Parenthood and other sister organizations is right out of the Talmud, right out of Babylon. As with almost everything contrary to the Bible and to Yahweh's laws, it originates in the Babylonian Talmud, the religion of the Jews. And if you don't like it, all I can say is talk, because that's just the way it is. Now, Exodus 21 alone, no matter what Judaism teaches, establishes that life begins at conception rather than at birth. However, let me assure you that there's much more biblical evidence that I want to share with you on this issue before we close this message out. That's much more biblical evidence than just what's found in the Torah or the law. Turn with me, if you would, to Job chapter 3. Job chapter 3, beginning with verse 11. It says, why, and this is, of course, this is one of the times during Job's despair. And by the way, Job didn't always endure so well. You know, he did pretty much up until the point in time that when his wife was saying, why don't you just go die? He had enough manhood in him to say, forget it, that's not the way it's going to be. If God gives us good, we've got to take the bad too. But from that point on, I'm not so sure Job is such a great example. And this is certainly maybe one of the cases. Job chapter 3 and verse 11, it says, why died I not from the womb? Now let me stop there before we read on. That term, from the womb, could have just as correctly been translated in the womb, as it was in Job 31 and verse 15, where we find this. It says, did not he that made me in the womb make him, and did not one fashion us in the womb? Same Hebrew phrase, actually same Hebrew word that's translated from the womb in Job 3 is translated in the womb in Job 31. And note that from that verse, that last passage, that Job recognized that while even in the womb of his mother, he was a creation of God. Now, back to Job chapter 3 and verse 11. Again, why died I not from the womb or in the womb? And by the way, in fact, as we will see in this passage, in the womb is just not another possible correct translation of the word in this case. As we're going to see as we continue on, the context proves that it's the right choice for the translation of that word. In fact, that's how the New American Standard, NIV, and I think most of the other translations translate it as in the womb. Verse 11, why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees prevent me? I believe that should be, why did the knees not prevent me? Or why the breath that I should suck? For now should I have lain still and been quiet. I should have slept, then had I been at rest. With kings and counselors of the earth, which built desolate places for themselves, or with princes that had gold who filled their homes with silver, or as an hidden, untimely birth. New American Standard says miscarriage, calls it a miscarriage. Or of an hidden, untimely birth, I had not been as infants which never saw light. It has to be talking about a child that has died while in the womb, not after it's come out from the womb. Because once a child is born, it sees the light of day. And this is talking about one who has died in his mother's womb that never had the chance to see a light. He's in despair. He's covered with sores. He's lost everything as far as he's concerned. He's finally got so despairing, he's saying, why didn't I just die while in the womb before I was ever born? And so he's talking about a death while in the womb. You can't have a death unless you have a life. It's impossible. Verse 16, NASV says, or like a miscarriage which is discarded, I would not be as infants that never saw light. Verse 16, NIV puts it this way, or why was I not hidden in the ground like a stillborn child, like an infant who never saw the light of day? But here's what is especially interesting about this passage, and that is that the word infants is translated from the Hebrew word alal, which means suckling, according to Strong. And it is used, this is what's interesting about the word, is that it's used for both infants, both after and before being born. No discrepancy in the word that's used before birth and after birth for infants. Don't tell me that what millions of mothers have done to their children is not infanticide, the murder of infants. You might say, well, wait a minute, how can suckling be for a child while in the womb? I'm sure you've seen the pictures of the child in the mother's womb that's sucking a son. They're a suckling, just like those outside the womb. Speaking of God as the creator of life in the womb, turn with me to Psalms, or New American, I'm going to read it from New American Standard, so if you've got New American Standard, you might want to turn there. Psalms 139, 11 through 14, which says, if I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to thee. Speaking, of course, of Yahweh. And the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to thee. For thou didst form my inward parts. Thou didst weave me in my mother's womb. The psalmist recognized that he was something that God put together as a person, even in his mother's womb. I will give thanks to thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are thy works, and my soul knoweth it very well. We'll stop there for a minute. And how interesting. Often the same people known as environmentalists today who want to protect nature, they recognize as also wonderfully made, are in front of the line to destroy the wonderfully made embryo, fetus, and or infant. It's like they see this creation and they want to wave it before us, and it is wonderful, and they don't recognize why it's wonderful, but nonetheless they recognize that it's been wonderfully made, and they say, how dare we destroy it? And yet they'll take this one thing that's probably even more wonderful than anything else in creation, and they want to turn around and destroy it. Continuing, Psalms 139, verse 15, my frame was not hidden from thee when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Isn't the earth something, isn't the earth what they want to protect? Well, human life is a part of the earth, is it not? Because we were all formed from the dust of the ground, essentially, through Adam. Continuing, verse 16, thine eyes have seen my unformed substance. That term, unformed substance, there is the Hebrew word gulam, and it means wrapped. It's like a substance that like a cocoon of a butterfly. It's in that wrapped form, and it hasn't been unwrapped yet. But just because a present is wrapped doesn't mean that's any less a present. Just because a butterfly has been wrapped in a cocoon doesn't mean it's any less a butterfly. Just because there's this unformed, that's not its completed form, it's a wrapped substance in the mother's womb, doesn't make it any less a child. Thine eyes have seen mine unformed substance, and in thy book they were all written, the days that were ordained for me when as yet there was not one of them. Verse 16 in the NIV says, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Again, I'm not a fan of the NIV in most cases, but that's a beautiful rendition of that verse. In other words, days which began in my mother's womb. He saw the days before they ever began, as they began in the mother's womb. Now follow with me in this and see if it's not logical. What is murder or homicide? The termination of life, right? Okay, now, do you and I today possess life? And this is so simple, it's pathetic. I mean, this is like what you're talking about, Hirsch, in the first hour. How you this, but it makes no difference to those on the left. They've been so dumbed down and so, or have such agendas that they don't care whether there's logic to it or not. But to us, this is so simple and so logic, it's embarrassing for me to go through it. But murder and homicide is the termination of life, and you and I possess life today. So would we then be here alive today if our mothers had aborted us? Thus, if our mothers or some doctor had aborted us, they would have taken away the lives we have today. In this case, the word aborted is used properly in that our lives would have been aborted, would have been prematurely terminated. That's the proper use of that word, as long as you attach it to life. Now, for the sake of women who, and my heart does go out to many women, but for the sake of women who simply have been taken in by government policy or the liberals' philosophy, I have to believe that Yahweh looks upon them somewhat as victims themselves in this day and age, and possibly not as guilty of those who have formed such policy and who have, quote-unquote, philosophized away Yahweh's morality. And in order for such more, and to think, and when you think about it, in order for such mothers to be guilty of murder or first-degree murder, if you want to call it that, they must be cognizant that the fetus in their womb is a human life, and then with malicious intent snuff it out. I do think that there are women. It's hard for me to believe that they can, and in many cases, I think they've just allowed themselves to be convinced. And if that's the case, it's a different story. But I think there's been many a mother today because of the philosophizing away of the liberals and because of government policy that have truly been convinced that it was never a life to begin with. So in order for it to be murder, that must be understood according to God's law. In either case, thank God they made room for repentance and has provided a covering for all sins through the atoning blood of His Son. And men, don't think for a minute that this only pertains to women, that I'm only speaking to women. Listen, if men weren't the scoundrels, the moral reprobates that they often are, infanticide would not be anywhere near the issue for so many women today. You know what I'm talking about? You know, we always want to make this just a woman's problem. But in so many cases, the men are the ones who began the problem. In other words, if men were morally responsible, men like Joseph, who ran away from even the propositions of an immoral woman. I'm sure a beautiful immoral woman. And don't think that that wouldn't be difficult. Much more difficult for a man than it would be for a woman. But if we had men that were of the moral nature of Joseph, let me tell you, then there wouldn't be anywhere near the number of infant murders in today's society. Don't think for a minute, men, that it's just the problem of men, of women. In other words, it's a shared responsibility, and in most cases, and I'm not so sure, that the greatest guilt isn't to be laid at the feet of immoral and godless men. The murders of these infants that are going on in the land today. By the way, while I'm here, I would be remiss for the sake of future generations if I also didn't point out, and I remember, if you remember earlier in the message, I talked about an untold numbers of children that have been killed in a mass murder plot. Let me tell you, it's much more serious. There's many more than we've ever been told. And I'd be remiss if I didn't point out for the future generations of our people, because there's a lot of our people who don't know this, that there are many more men and women guilty of infant death than what we might initially think. Because to my knowledge, the only contraceptive today that is not that does not terminate life after conception is the diaphragm, including the pill, including all the rest of them. They all at least have the potential of also ending life in the womb. So once again, praise Yahweh for the propitiating blood of Yeshua the Christ, because it's a minority of people in today's promiscuous society that has not participated in one fashion or another in this horrific sin. Praise God for the blood of Christ. Maybe more so than we've ever understood before. Turn another passage. Jeremiah chapter 1. These will just take a minute. I know we're about out of time here, but I think we can do these as well. Jeremiah chapter 1, and beginning with verses 4 and 5, if I can get there. Jeremiah chapter 1, verses 4 and 5, where it says, "Then the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee, and before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee, and I ordained thee a prophet unto the nations." Not only did Yahweh know Jeremiah while he was in the womb of his mother, but he had already assigned a predetermined purpose for Jeremiah's life before he was ever in the womb. In other words, Jeremiah's life was viable. They want to talk about viability? Here's a verse that talks about viability and where it began. Jeremiah's life was viable and significant from the moment he was conceived. Even before so, because he had already been conceived in the mind of God. Jeremiah provides further evidence when, like Job in despair, he declared the following. He said, "Cursed be the day when I was born. Let the day not be blessed when my mother bore me. Cursed be the man who brought the news to my father, saying, A baby boy has been born to you, and made him very happy. But let the man be like the cities which Yahweh overthrew without relenting, and let him hear an outcry in the morning and a shout of alarm at noon, because he did not kill me before birth, so that my mother would have been my grave and her womb ever pregnant. Why did I ever come forth from the womb and look on trouble and sorrow so that the days have been spent in shame?" Jeremiah chapter 20 and verses 14 and 18. I'm not going to have time to go to Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. You can read it for yourself. But there in Yeshua's case, there was life before the womb, who lived prior to the womb, and thus there had to be life while in the womb from the moment of conception as well. And if that's not enough evidence, then you might want to consider the pregnancy of John the Immerser. And I want to try to get this one in. Luke chapter 1. Which time do I have? Okay, we'll do okay here. Luke chapter 1. And beginning with verse 39, where it says, "And Mary arose in those days and went into the hill country with haste unto the city of Judea, and entered into the house of Zacharias and saluted Elizabeth. And it came to pass that when Elizabeth heard the salutation of Mary, the babe, who became John the Immerser, leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Ghost." But not only that, but John, while in his mother's womb, experienced the emotion of joy. Jump down to verse 42 through 44. "And she spake out with a loud voice and said, Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb. And whence is this to me that the mother of my Lord shall come to me? For lo, as soon as the voice of thy salutation sounded in my ears, the baby leaped womb for joy." Leaped in his mother's womb for joy. I want you to think about that. Think about that babies in the womb of their mothers can experience joy. I found this in my files this morning. This is Monday, September 21st, 1987, Seattle Times. I wish I had time to read the whole article to you. "Unborn babies show awareness. They sense outside events, doctors say." It talks about different incidents where they've been able to prove that those babies actually experience things there while in the womb. Think about that. Babies can leap with joy in the womb of their mother. And if they can experience joy, then you think about this, and they can also experience the full range of all other emotions, including terror, as the butcher's knife intrudes their safe haven, at least what they thought was their safe haven, to stop their beating hearts. pretty sobering. At least I hope that we haven't been so desensitized, so callous, that we can't be moved by the knowledge of that. By the way, that Greek word babe there is used just like infant in the Old Testament is used, whether it's talking about one that's after they've been born or whether they have been born. For John, while he was in the womb, he leapt for joy, the babe. Same word used for Christ as the babe in the manger. In conclusion, consider that Yahweh reveals Himself. Yahweh reveals Himself as the Father of the fatherless. Psalms 82:3. The protector of the weak. Psalms 82:4. And the vindicator of the oppressed. Psalms 10:17 and 18. And His eye is on the weak and the defenseless. Psalms 140 and verse 12. In fact, we're told by Yahshua Himself that inasmuch as you have done it to the least of these, you think about that, inasmuch as you've done it to the least of these, you've also done it to Me. Matthew 25 and verse 40. Consequently, don't think for a moment that the blood of these innocents will go unpunished. They cry from the ground their blood. A woman's right to choose, as the pro-abortionists using their term like to call it, is really a woman's legal, not lawful, but legal right, given a right by the government, by an unlawful government, to choose to kill. I could have seen the sunshine. I could have known the spring. I could have watched the robins fly. I could have heard them sing. I could have smelled the flowers. I could have felt the snow. The things you take for granted are things I'll never know. You could have heard my laughter. You could have dried my tears. You could have watched me playing and growing through the years. You could have shown me rainbows God painted in the sky. You could have held me in your arms. Instead, you made me die. I might have been your daughter. I might have been your son. I might have learned to crawl and stand and walk and even run. I might have felt you hug me as your milk began to fill me. I might have called you mama. Instead, you chose to kill me. They say have an abortion, it's your legal right. They say I'm not a person, I can't put up a fight. They say that I'm not born yet, I haven't drawn a breath. My heart beats in my mother's womb as they sentence me to death. If only you'd have loved me like only mothers do, if only you'd have given me what your mother gave to you, the gift of life, the gift of love, with me you could have shared. I could have seen the sunshine if only you'd have cared. Let's stand.